Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. In celebration of the International Day of the Girl, we'll hear a talk by Sister Deirdre Mullen, Director of the Mercy Global Concern, as well as the Executive Director of the Partnership for Global Justice, both at the United Nations. She'll speak on the topic, There's a Girl Out There Who Needs You, Empowering Girls Through Education, One Girl at a Time. Sister Mullen's appearance was co-sponsored by the Eileen Lieben Center for Women at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 2, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Meg Maynard, programming intern for the Lieben Center for Women at Creighton.
Today we're joined by Sister Deirdre Mullen to help celebrate the International Day of the Girl. On December 19th, 2011, the United Nations General Assembly declared October 11th as the International Day of the Girl Child to recognize girls' rights and the unique challenges girls face around the world. The message that this day promotes is very important. My awareness on this topic was expanded when I met Sister Deirdre in Philadelphia in June 2012. She spoke of the girls in developing countries, the girls whose lives are plagued by war and poverty. To break this struggle of oppression, we must advocate for the education of our sisters beyond borders. As Sister Deirdre said in 2012, we must take time to be kind. Sister Deirdre Mullen is a Sister of Mercy. She has served as the director of the Mercy Global Concern, as well as the executive director of the Partnership for Global Justice, both at the United Nations. In 2011, she was appointed the executive director of Mercy Reaches Mercy, an organization which promotes the education of girls in the developing world. Please join me in welcoming Sister Deirdre Mullen to Creighton University as she presents There is a Girl Out There Who Needs You, Empowering Girls Through Education, One Girl at a Time.
Thank you, Meg. And you can all hear me. And I'm delighted to be here this evening to be part of this lecture series, which is held in a building or is part of a program named after Eileen B. Lieben, a woman who got it and realized that girls, as well as men, have the potential to reach for a better world. As you can tell, I am not from these parts. I'm from a city with two names, sometimes called Derry, sometimes called Londonderry. But it was here in this city, which is known all over the world for all of the wrong reasons, that I learned one of the greatest lessons of my life. I was 15 years old, and the Troubles, as the modern war in Ireland was known, was really raging. And I was sitting at our kitchen table doing my homework when shots rang out. We knew it was very close. We had been used with gunfire and bombings, but this was very close. My father told us to stay away from the windows, but my mother ignored him, as she usually did, and opened our front door. There at our gate, a young British soldier had been wounded. With no thought for her own safety, my mother went to his aid, and he died in her arms. And I tell you this because you are a country at war at present. Many young men and women from the United States are in foreign parts, and sometimes they see ugly, bad things. But it is my hope that there are women like my mother out there, who will go to fallen American soldiers should they need the comfort of a human being. I am sure that you will all agree with me that our world has grown coarse and cruel, and we need more women and men like my mother, who, of every creed and class, who will reach out and do what needs to be done. The news emerging in recent weeks, and especially the horror in the Middle East, is a reminder that we need to be vigilant in our thoughts and in our words, but also in our actions. It is not enough to be compassionate. We must act. As General Omar Bradley reminded us when he said, "We are stumbling blindly through a spiritual darkness while toying with the precarious secrets of life and death. The world has achieved brilliance without wisdom, power without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. We know more about war than we do about peace, more about killing than we do about living." And in the past few months, it seems as though we have reached a terrible dark place as human beings. Beheadings, starvation, thousands uprooted from their homeland, Ebola, fear. And for me, as we celebrate today, the week when we are looking at remembering the plight of the girl child, for me, the new low was reached when I heard a young British woman dressed in full jihadist uniform with a knife, 22 years old. The accent was Manchester, England, with a knife in her hand saying, her dream, her claim to fame is to be the first female ISIS member who will behead another human being. And I hear that in this week when we are going to celebrate the girl of the child, the year of the child, the day of the child. And that, my friends, is why we need centres such as the Lieben Centre, which promotes and values the education of women and of girls. The fact that you are here tonight is important because we need small pockets of people who are prepared to go out and make a difference. Sometimes we don't need the thousands. We need a committed small group of people who are going to try and to make a difference. I believe you can be change makers. I have dedicated most of my adult life to educating girls in this country, in Ireland, and through the Mercy Reaches Mercy network in various parts of the world. And as we sit here this evening, about 200 Nigerian girls are still in captivity. They were targeted quite simply because they were girls who wanted an education. Why? Because Boko Haram, the militant organization, knows something very important. They know that educated girls and women will ask smart questions. They know that educated girls will question extremes of poverty. They know that educated girls will question why a girl was buried alive because she named the men in her village who raped her on the way to school, as happened in Sudan in March. They know that educated girls will question what is family honour and why a father can set his 14-year-old daughter on fire and burn her alive because she walked hand in hand with a 14-year-old boy, as happened 6 weeks ago in Tunisia. An educated girl will ask why women earn less than men simply because she is female, as a woman named Lily Ledenbetter asked here in the United States. Boko Haram, the Taliban, ISIS all know and understand that a generation of girls with books and pencils and with the ambition to dream another world into being is a greater threat to their closed mind vision of the world than any military. The over 60 girls who escaped the clutches of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, where are they? they are back in school. And they teach each of us an unimpeachable truth. If you give people the tools to fix their lives, they can and will make a difference in their respective communities. I have seen this again and again in my work as an educator at the United Nations. I have seen it in various places around the world. And as an Irish person, we are famous for telling stories, and I'll share a few of the stories with you. I told you the story of the impact of my mother going to the aid of a perceived enemy in my country. And she was with that young 19-year-old when he died. And her saying to us, you know, no flag, no ideal is worth the telephone call that some mother in England is going to get tonight, that her 19-year-old boy has been shot in the name of Irish freedom. I have seen the value of education in a guard at the United Nations who was given a $50 scholarship by one of our sisters working in Kenya. That man told us that as a result of that $50 scholarship, he got another scholarship and another scholarship. Today, he is head of the United Nations Safety Department at UN headquarters. I shared with some people at supper a young friend of mine who I taught in Ireland. She was a very bright girl, and the next thing I heard, she'd gone in for a beauty competition. I couldn't believe it, and I thought, why is she doing that? And she became Miss Ireland, very beautiful girl. She was doing an engineering degree. And then it was reported in the paper that Miss Ireland was going off to India because she had been told in school by Sister Deirdre Mullen, that was me, I didn't know anything about this, that it was when you were given much, you also had to pay back. And she used the opportunity of the first few years as a young engineer to go to India and help them to build wells. One of the students of the Mercy schools in Philadelphia is at present the special advisor to the ambassador of the United States to the United Nations, Samantha Power. She's a wonderful ambassador. You must be very, very proud of her. And Colleen King is a Mercy girl. Bernadette Negwa, one of our sisters from rural Kenya, again, from poverty-stricken background, and because of a little scholarship, she went on to do great things. The Mercy students and their parents, who are part of our network and who form the Girls Rising Project, both here in this country and in Ireland, have done absolutely amazing things. Studies in the last 10 years carried out by both UNICEF and the United Nations make it very, very clear that violence against the girl child is a growing problem. Whether it is female genital mutilation, known as FGM, selective abortions, forced marriages, I mean, I'm talking about little girls as young as 8 years old being forced to marry guys of 39, 40, 50. Unbelievable. Forced marriages or lack of education, girls are most at risk, both at home and in society, in the workplace, and this is particularly so when there is conflict. And in the little booklet that I produced, There Is a Girl Out There Who Needs You, I have outlined four major problems facing the girl child today. And Bishop Desmond Tutu very graciously wrote the foreword to this book. He is a personal friend of my brother, and I nabbed him when he was in my brother's house in Dublin, and I asked him, well, could I put your name to this? And he said, absolutely. He said he is very, very, very passionate about this kind of work because he is the UN Special Advisor to the Secretary General on child marriages. For instance, Desmond Tutu has said in his work reporting to the Secretary General that we must stop child marriages. He said the practice of child marriages is not only a violation of human rights, but is also a moral challenge. I mean, just imagine a youngster of 9, 10, and 11, and some of the stories are in this book. You know, they think they're going to a party, and it seems all grand while the party's going on, and then they're taken off and they're violated. They're 8 and 9 and 10. It's unbelievable. Desmond Tutu says it's one of the greatest moral challenges of our time because every day 13,000 girls under the age of 18, some as young as 7, are married, mainly in Asia. They are forced away from their families, endure sexual and physical abuse, and bear children while children themselves. At the present rate, by 2020, some 50 million girls will be married before they turn 14. That has to stop. And guess what? It's happening here as well. Because some immigrant families are going back to their countries of origin and they're marrying off their girls. Nora from Yemen tells her story. I was forced to marry a man in his 30s when I was 11 years old. Her story is typical of many young girls in her country. Reflecting on her wedding day, Nora remembers the childish delight of any 11-year-old girl playing at being an adult. She was thrilled at family and friends gathering for the three-day event in the Yemeni port, the port city of Al-Hudra. There were traditional singers, and the little girl was dressed in three beautiful dresses, two green and one white, for each day of the celebrations. Then everyone left. And Nora recalls, what had not dawned on me was that I would be abused and abused by a criminal. So that's one of the issues facing girls today. Second is female genital mutilation. What is it? It is the cutting or circumcision, a procedure involving the partial or total removal of female external genitalia for non-medical reasons. It is practiced all over the world, and in many countries it is monitored by UNICEF. Most of the cutting takes place on girls aged between 5 and 14. Girls are cut in this way as it's considered a necessary part of being a female child. It's motivated by cultural beliefs about modesty, and it seems to be a way of protecting a girl's virginity. Then the next issue we have, it's called the lost girls. And I read about this when I was at home in Ireland. I read it in a UK newspaper. A recent report in the United Kingdom has highlighted the practice used by ethnic minorities, some of whom live in Great Britain, of aborting a female baby. The illegal abortion is solely to ensure that families have sons. The practice of sex selection is now so commonplace that it has affected the natural 50-50 balance of boys and girls within the immigrant population and has led to the disappearance of between 1,400 and 4,700 female children from the national consensus of England and Wales. Understanding this problem, and you know, I think you should reflect on it, because I know, you know, in Ireland, where I'm from, there's great joy when a little boy is born. It's going to hold on to the name. You know, I had three brothers, and they were great guys. And I used to be told to make their bed. And I'd say, but I didn't lie in it, you know. And this whole notion somehow, and I think we really need to look at how we rear our sons, how we rear our daughters, and is there preferential treatment? Is there something special about the boy child? And I think we need to honestly ask that question in our hearts and consider how families rear boys or girls. Understanding the problem of son preference, it's a global phenomenon that has existed throughout history. Today, in some societies, son preference is so strong and sex selection practices so common at the population level, the number of boys being born is greater than the number of girls. And you think of what's happening now at the moment in China. Remember, they had the one-child policy. And most of the children who the one-child policy were girls, or boys, rather. And there's going to be major sociological problems in that country into the future. Particularly in India and China, a deep-seated preference for having sons over daughters is due to a variety of factors that continue to make males more socially and economically valuable than females. Inheritance, land rights, and you can read about that again in the booklet, which is available at the back. And you know, I can't help, I keep counting people. I spend my time counting people. When I was getting on the plane at Chicago yesterday, and getting on the plane from Chicago to come here to Omaha, and I was sitting in row 8, so I could see into what would they tell us it was called first class. All they got was a bag of peanuts. You know, I could do without the peanuts and save $100 for sitting up there. Anyhow, but it was interesting. All 14 seats were occupied by males. And I said to myself, now what's that all about? I do count those kind of things. I can't help myself. But the big problem that we have at the moment, currently in the world, and it's something I'm really working on, is the link between education and hunger. Educating girls is the most powerful and effective way to address global poverty. When a girl is provided with even the most basic education, statistics have shown and proven that not only do most of them graduate, but they also develop the skills they need to negotiate key life decisions. And for the last number of years, I've been involved in a project called the Mercy Girl Effect. And some of the young women who attended Mercy High School, including Meg here, journeyed with me, and also Felicia are here tonight. And they were part of that program, and they would talk about it being, you know, just a whole life-changing experience. The sister that I work with in Sudan, and I've worked with people all over the world, she is a great believer in the motto. She says, feeding children, there's a great link between education and hunger. And she said, there is a link between feeding children is about investing in the future. When you feed a child, you invest in the future. Many parents in the developing world, when they do not have money to send their children to school, they will send their boy child rather than their girl child, who's sent off to gather the water or to gather the firewood for the fire. So, you know, when a school provides food, it's a great incentive for parents to send their girl children to school. And when I'm on the subject of water, and I was very glad to be given this reusable water bottle, I am absolutely deaf on bottled water. Water is a human right. We should not be selling water. And I was kind of shocked to see that it is for sale in a Jesuit university. Water is a human right. And those of us who keep buying water are making it into a commodity that poor people cannot afford. It is a human right. And we use reusable water bottles, and there's nothing as nice as good, clear, clean, fresh water, and you can get it out of the tap for free. So maybe that's something you could think, because most of the water carriers in the world are girl children. They're not allowed to go to school. They have to go off and collect the water. So this issue of hunger and education. And I'm sure we all, as human beings, have experienced hunger. But thankfully, we've experienced craving for food. But thankfully, we live in a part of the world where both food and education are readily available. That is not so for many children, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. I have seen swollen bellies about hunger. And it's absolutely, it's unbelievable. Parents just staring into oblivion, not knowing where to turn when they have a hungry little child and they don't have any money or they don't have any way of getting food. It's an awful, heart-wrenching thing to witness. And it should not happen in a world of plenty. The violence directed against schoolgirls, whether in Nigeria by Boko Haram or the Taliban in Pakistan, should act as an alarm bell for all of us who care about the right of every girl, every child, to go to school. But as well as the extremists, the Boko Haram extremists, there is another terrible problem which is affecting the girl child, and that is hunger. Hunger is defined as the scarcity of food in a country. A hungry child cannot concentrate on lessons, so providing nutritious food means that a child will perform better in a classroom. The militants believe that education is a powerful tool. They want to deny it to girls. But the other problem is hunger. And the main beneficiaries of school meals are girls, because the provision of food at school encourages families to educate all their children, not just the boys. And Sister Kathy saying, you know, in Sudan, where she's working, that a lot of parents now are sending their girls to school basically because she's giving them breakfast and she's giving them lunch and a take-home portion. And that's a real encouragement. When you have nothing at home, it's good to send your children to school. So providing food at school is a great incentive. One of the greatest stories I have ever heard, and I think for me it sums up what we are trying to do as a Mercy Network. One of our sisters is a doctor with Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and she was taking a group of students to Haiti. They had just arrived in Florida to fly to Haiti when the earthquake struck. So they were stuck, and the question was, will we go forward or will we go on back? The students were not allowed by the university to go with her, but she decided to go, because she's a paediatrician. Off she goes to... there was a nurse with her, a sister, and off they go to Haiti. And there's makeshift, it's chaos, absolute chaos. There's makeshift beds all over the place, tables, everything. She said she went into this makeshift tent, and she could smell the stench, and she knew there was gangrene somewhere. She's lifting up sheets, and she finds a little boy. And she knows, you know, his leg has to come off. And she said, I have to take you to the operating room. I need to remove your leg. And he said, please, sister, please, doctor, please don't remove my leg. Because that child knew he lived in a country, unlike our countries, that if you lose a leg, you'll get a limb. He knew he was going to be an invalid and the stigma of that for the rest of his life. And she said, well, if I don't remove your leg, you're going to die. And he bit his lip. He was 12 years old, sitting in a hospital bed on his own. And he bit his lips, and she said the tears ran down his cheeks. And he said, it's okay. You can take off my leg, because I can't bear to see my daddy cry again, the way he cried when he found my mother and my two sisters under the rubble of our house. That's the witness of a 12-year-old. She also told me about, you know, working for 2 days and there was no food coming in because of the chaos, and the airfield had been destroyed for airplanes to come. And she remembered that she had a bag of nuts somewhere. So she went to her backpack and she found them. And she took out the nuts, and she said she was just about to put them into her mouth. She was so hungry, and she'd been operating for 18 hours. And she said she saw this very hungry little pair of eyes staring at the nuts in her hand. And her head said, get the nuts into your mouth. You need food. You need strength. You've more operations to do. But her heart said, this little kid is hungry too. So she handed some of the nuts to the little girl. And what did she do? She took a few and handed them to a child in the next bed and to the next bed and to the next bed. And somehow that little girl knew that it was very important to share. We who are part of the Mercy Network, where we try to pick a project every single year. I think what we're trying to do is summed up in that little girl's gesture. Because as a network, we have helped children, not only girls, but all children, any child who is suffering. We've helped children in Pakistan. We've helped children in this country, in the United States. We've helped children, particularly trafficked children in England. We've helped children in Ireland who have been trafficked, children in Kenya who have been trafficked, South Africa, India, Haiti, Peru. And hopefully, you know, you might think, and it's not always about raising money. Sometimes it's about a change of my own personal behaviour. So maybe this afternoon or this evening, as a result of this presentation, each of us here might resolve to do something and send out a ripple effect. The United Nations Children's Programme stresses the need to educate girls. Education is a silver bullet required to rid the world of hunger. And I can share with you many stories on how a $50 scholarship has made and does change a life. We have started something called the Mercy Girl Effect. And one of the things that we've done is we have produced scholarships. And for $50, a person is named and given a scholarship. And a child goes to school in that person's name. And I'm happy to share with you today that actually Creighton, the student health department, with Angela here, Angela Meg's mother, she has provided 4 scholarships already. Just small little effort, but it has made a difference to 4 little girls in different parts of the world. And, you know, I remember my brother was turning 65, and I mean, I didn't know what to get him. The guy is everything. And in the end, I decided I would get it. I got a scholarship for him. He was absolutely thrilled. He said, "You sent a kid to school in my name." He was thrilled to bits. You know, it's just been that creative and making a difference. And I remember we were trying to, I was in a school in New Jersey, and the girls were saying, "Sister, that idea of the scholarships is fantastic, but how do you sell it to the rest of the girls on the campus?" And I said, "Mm-hmm." And I looked at their feet because it was winter, and they were all wearing Uggs. And I said, "You know, you're all wearing 2 scholarship on your feet. You know, just think about it." They said, "That's a great idea." So they invited me back about 6 months later. And every time they raised $50, they cut out an Ugg. And the corridors were the whole place was covered in Uggs. They raised over $5,000. Just as simple, little simple things that can make a difference. And it doesn't have to be one person giving 50. It can be 2 people giving 25. Or it can be 5 people giving 10. Or 10 people giving 5. You know, we can just do something, but it makes a profound difference in the life of a child. So our challenge for 2014 and 2015 is particularly to take on the challenge of hunger, particularly hunger affecting children, and particularly the girl child. Because, you know, between today and tomorrow, and I found this staggering, and I went back and I kept checking the records. Could this possibly be true? 40,000 children will starve to death. And 40,000 children will die the day after and the day after. And I just kept thinking, these figures are staggering. If you live in Sudan, the mortality rate for children under 5 is 270 for every 1,000 deaths. If you live in the US or Ireland, the mortality rate is fewer than 10. The contrast is stark. Our challenge, so what do we do? What do we do about this? Well, I think we need to change the way we are. And the first thing I say is never to waste food or water. My thing is take what you need, not what you want. I don't care how much food you put on your plate, finish it. Take what you need, not what you want. The second thing I say is water. change lives by using water from the tap and using one of these reusable bottles. Water is a human right. It is not a commodity. And I would suggest, you know, in the next year, if you want to do something, it doesn't have to be necessarily for the work that we're doing. It can be a food bank in Omaha right on your own doorstep. You know, at times, change your drinking habits and drink water and give the money for your intended soda water to a hunger cause. Read as much as you can about causes of world hunger. Because as we know, and you've seen it in this country, and I've experienced it as well, because I lived in the East Coast during Sandy and we had to evacuate, natural disasters causes hunger, the destruction of human lives. Conflicts cause hunger, as in our school in Sudan. We built a school in Sudan. The children were ready to go to the school. They had to evacuate because of the war. The school we've built is in the Diocese of Darfur, where you've heard of the genocide there. What's happening now is the government are coming and they're after the Nuba people because the Nuba people live in the Nuba Mountains and they have natural resources. And the government now is dropping bombs, trying to get the people to leave their ancestral home. Hunger is caused because of poverty, poor agricultural infrastructure, over-exploitation of the environment. And Sister Kathy, our sister in Sudan, she can provide breakfast, lunch, and a take-home portion for $50 per year. And I suggested to the girls this morning when I was in Mercy High School, maybe you should check out and go with your mum, or you girls, or you students, go shopping and see how much you can buy for $50. And I don't think it's going to last for a whole year. I think it's important that we count our blessings and know that it's important to reach out and help another. I'm going to share with you a true story that really had an amazing impact on me, because we never know where a kindness would lead. And God knows, you know, I have been a foreign national in this country and I've experienced, you know, numerous blessings. You people are known all over the world for your generosity and your kindness. And it's something you need to guard very, very carefully. It's a very important quality of the American country, of the American nationals. This is a true story. It's called Paid For With One Glass of Milk. One day, a poor boy who was selling goods from door to door to pay his way through school, and he knew he had only a dime in his pocket and he was very, very hungry. He decided he would ask for a meal at the next house, because he just did not know how he was going to go on. But he lost his nerve when a lovely young woman appeared at the door, and instead of a meal, he asked for a glass of water. She gave him a glass of milk. He drank it slowly and then said to her, "How much do I owe you?" And she replied, "Mother has taught us never to accept pay for kindness. I thank you from the bottom of my heart." As Howard Kelly left that house, he felt not only stronger physically, but also his faith in God and in humanity had been renewed. He had been ready to give up and quit. Years later, that young woman became critically ill. The local doctors were baffled. They finally sent her to the big city, where they called in the specialists to study her rare disease. And Dr. Kelly was called in for the consultation. When he heard the town that she came from, a strange light filled his eyes. Immediately he rose and went to the hall of the hospital, down the hall of the hospital to her room. Dressed in his doctor's gown, he went in to see her. He recognized her at once. He went back to the consultation room, determined to do his best to save her life. From that day, he gave her special attention to her case. After a long struggle, the battle was won. Dr. Kelly requested that the business office passed the final bill to him for approval. He looked at it and then wrote something on the side. The bill was sent to her room. She feared opening the bill, for she was sure that it would take the rest of her life to pay for it. Finally, she looked and something caught her attention, because on the side of the bill, she read the following words: paid for by one glass of milk. You know, we never know the ripple effect of kindness. And finally, I just want to share with you something that President, because we're living in a world of tremendous change, constant things happening, and we have to be prepared to take into account, you know, how are we going to do our bit to make this world a better place. Last week, I had the privilege of being in the General Assembly when your President spoke. And he said, "Today, whether you live in downtown New York or in my grandmother's village 200 miles from Nairobi, you can hold in your hand more information than the world's greatest libraries. Together we have learned how to cure disease, harness the power of the wind and the sun. The very existence of an institution like the United Nations is a unique achievement. The people of the world coming together to resolve their differences peacefully and solve their problems together. I often tell young people in the United States that this is the best time in history to be born, for you are more likely than ever to be literate, to be healthy, and to be free to pursue your dreams." And the President continued, "And yet, there is a terrible unease in our world, a sense that the very forces that have brought us together have created new dangers and made us very difficult as nations to coexist. As we gather," and he was speaking last week, and it's nearer now, "as we gather, an outbreak of Ebola overwhelms the public health systems in West Africa." I understand now they think there's 10 cases in this country, or they're investigating, you know, and it's very, very scary. "There is Russian aggression in Europe. There is brutality of terrorists in Syria and Iraq. And it's as if the world has been gripped in darkness." And the President went on to say, "I want to speak in particular about the Muslim world." He said, "You come from a great tradition that stands for education, not ignorance, innovation, not destruction, the dignity of life, not murder. Those who call you away from this path are betraying this tradition, not defending it." And he finally said, "I call on all people, and especially my own citizens." He said, "The world looks at us and they see us as decent and dignified and courageous people. At this crossroads," he said, "I promise that the United States will do all we can to change the course of darkness in our world. We are heirs of a proud legacy of freedom, and we will do everything we can to secure that legacy for generations to come. Join me in this mission for today's children and tomorrow's." And I think that's a powerful message, because I often pass the Statue of Liberty in New York, and I often think of the countless people who came to this country looking for freedom, looking to get away from what had happened in their own countries, from starvation, from war. And this country has offered people so much. And I think that's your proud heritage, but do not take it as a given. And finally, and then we'll take some questions, never, ever, ever, you know, we can say, "Wish there was this auditorium was filled with 200 people. You know, there's 60 or 70 people here. And the ripple effect of 60 or 70, because I'm going to share with you a final true story. In a book called The Shut-In Freedom Fighter, Hope Harold Mould shares the story and the power of one woman. This older woman, in the midst of failing health, dedicates her isolation, her time, and her energy, writing letters for the freeing of prisoners of conscience. Through Amnesty International, she adopts an unjustly detained political prisoner in Indonesia. The organization gave her the sole responsibility for obtaining his release. She knows nothing about the case for obtaining his release. She knows nothing about his case, so she writes letter after letter after letter to the prisoner's family, as well as to countless impassioned pleas to every governmental official in Indonesia, from the dictator to the guards at the prisoner's jail. After many months and hundreds of letters, she receives a letter from the prisoner. He is free. The letter reads, "They kept hearing and seeing my name. I was lost. I was nothing to them. Thank God for you, my woman. You kept my name alive. When they finally released me, they said my file was 2 inches thick with correspondence. Most of the correspondence was from you. They said my file was too much trouble for just one prisoner. I owe you my life. May every political prisoner's file become 2 inches thick." So I say to you today, in the name of girls suffering and imprisoned all over the world, and as we come to celebrate the International Day of the Girl Child next Friday on the 10th, the 11th of October at the United Nations, I implore you, go to where the silence is and say something. Thank you.
So at this time, if anyone has any questions for Sister Deirdre, just point down Hamed or Amanda, and they will bring the mic to you.
So throughout the presentation, you were talking about water not being a commodity, and especially with the corporations highly monetizing it, what do you really feel like appropriate steps to actually move to get past the system we're living in right now?
I think we have to begin, you know, it's too big to think it's way up there. We have to do a big, big thing. Each of us, if every person in this room decided, I will never buy bottled water again, that's 70 people, you know, and it's that ripple effect. Because we had a little bit of a discussion about this during dinner tonight, and part of the problem is the corporations are everywhere, and they're investing in universities and in colleges, and so you have at one level, you know, the situation with do you take the investment money or, you know, what do you do? I think we have to walk the moral road, but that's for each individual. And I remember I was on a board in the Northeast, and there was a problem because Lady Gaga used to give quite a bit of money. It was a place in the Bronx. And of course, some of the board people said, we should not be taking her money. It's not ethical. And, you know, I said to myself, I thought of Jesus and the woman at the well. You know, there's no such thing as non-ethical money. All money is tainted. And the problem with tainted money, they're taint enough of it. You know, you have to think about that. Money is tainted because the very people who were objecting to taking Lady Gaga's money, and, you know, I don't know Lady Gaga's heart, but I thought it was a pretty good thing that she did to a women's centre in the Bronx. But the very people who were objecting to taking her money took money from the banks. So, you know, I think we really need to go into our own sacred space and ask the question. So in relation to the water, it's a big, big issue, and I think it's one person at a time. You know, look what we've done with the whole thing about smoking in how smoking has been banned. you know, and so I think it's people taking little steps that take giant strides. Okay, thanks.
In your occupation, I presume you see a lot of negativity in your occupation, like in days and weeks. And I just was wondering how you keep a positive attitude in light of that negativity.
How do I keep positive? And well, you know, the United Nations is the craziest place in the world to work. You know, particularly the Security Council, you know, they veto this crowd, so they veto that crowd, so they veto this crowd, so they veto that crowd, and they're nuts. And then you have to remember, because you think, this, why am I here? This is the craziest place in the world to work, because there's slow pace movements. And then you remember the humanitarian wing. You know, where there's the disasters, where there's the crisis, where there's the hunger, the United Nations is there, and it's feeding hungry people. It is building, it's where there's been terrible deforestation, it's planting trees, it's trying to clean up environments. So when you read about the humanitarian wing of the United Nations, it helps you to restore your energy and your spirit. But I just work with absolutely amazing people, and you hear amazing stories, and we run into amazing people. And so therefore, I mean, to be here in this university, I had the most amazing afternoon. First of all, walking around this campus, I mean, you're so lucky. But to me, I had a magical afternoon when I went into the multicultural centre. Is that what you call it? Where's Molly? Yeah. It was fantastic. I mean, the energy of the director, the artwork on the walls, the stories of Native American peoples who have been, you know, robbed of their rights. And I was sharing with him my friend. She is a Holocaust professor, and she's now looking at, you know, the relationship between the Holocaust and the Holocaust of Native Americans in this country. Looking at, you know, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. That's one of the books that she has the students reading. And I was telling the director there, but this man is just, this is not a job for him. It's a way of life. And when you meet people like that, that keeps you focused and that keeps you positive, because you know there's a whole lot of people out there doing this kind of work, because we know of our inherent, you know, goodness as human beings. And, you know, people often say to me, how do you like being in America? You know, the Americans are so loud, they're so this and they're so that. And I said, well, you know, I've never really met a rude American. People are as rude to you, are as nice to you as you are to them. Isn't that right? You know, and I just think, you know, you really, I thought it was amazing when the girls were abducted and I was talking to this elderly nun. She was sitting in a wheelchair, 94 years old, very alert. All her marbles are still in place. She mightn't be able to walk, but her marbles are in place. And she says, thank God the Yanks have gone, because they'll find them. Now, the problem is the Yanks would have found them, but you were dealing with a corrupt Nigerian government who, honest to God, I have a file here, and I just must leave it. And you sort of think, you know, what has happened to the girls? Why has not one student been rescued? You know, why was it not reported until 1 month after it happened? Because the government is corrupt. You know, and I think we have to constantly remind people that we are so lucky, even though we mightn't like our politicians, or we mightn't like each other, Republican, Democrat, and all the stuff that goes on when we watch it, whether you watch Fox or whether you watch CNN. But at least, you know, at least it's kind of a kind of a civilized conversation. Do you know what I'm saying? Whereas, what happened in Nigeria was absolutely appalling. And the fact that the president never even met the parents of the girls until nearly 10 weeks later, and he only did so as a result of media pressure. And I met someone earlier on here tonight. I think his name is Nico. Is that your name? Yeah, Nico. And he's telling me he wants to be a documentary filmmaker. And, you know, that is such important work. because we need the documentary film workers to go to places like Nigeria and to tell us the truth. We need the truth because people, you know, need other human beings to shine light when they're living in darkness. So that's the kind of thing that keeps me impassioned and keeps me moving along, because I've met those people who are prepared to go to those places. And I mean, one group now at the moment who are being severely targeted are journalists. Why? Because they're telling the truth. I mean, I'm just waiting now to see what's going to happen in Hong Kong, because that is a very serious situation. And thank God for the reporters who are there telling us the truth. So thank you for your question. There was another hand somewhere. Yep. I love it. It's all the young men.
In all of your work internationally, what's the biggest change you've seen in education of girls over the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, I've been lucky, and I've traveled to various parts of the world. And in the Makuru slums, where the Sisters of Mercy worked, Sister Angela Hardigan, she's a chemistry major, and she now has, it started as a primary school, or a grade school, you call it, and now started one school, now there's four schools, and now she's built a secondary school. And some of her students are now moving on to university. And a lot of it is as a result of the $50 scholarship, you know. Like, people are living in terrible poverty, but somehow they dream big and they realise, I've got to get my child out of poverty, and the way out of poverty is through education. So it's to see, well, you go back and you see these little schools, and you see it has a sister little school, and then you see it has a second level school, and the people somehow, in the midst of their poverty, realise that education is my child's ticket out of this slum. So that's been really the development that I've seen. And that's just so worthwhile. Thank you. So thank you all. I think you've got quite a bit of information. And as I say, there's a girl out there who needs you, and we can do it one person at a time. Okay?
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. In celebration of the International Day of the Girl, we've heard a talk by Sister Deirdre Mullen, Director of the Mercy Global Concern, as well as the Executive Director of the Partnership for Global Justice, both at the United Nations. She spoke on the topic, There's a Girl Out There Who Needs You, Empowering Girls Through Education, One Girl at a Time. Sister Mullen's appearance was co-sponsored by the Eileen Lieben Center for Women at Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 2, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.